You have seconds to think about it. We're about to start.
Very good.
Here we go.
Should we say gentlemen assemble?
if you feel the need. I was going to go with something like this.
Banded together from remote galaxies are 13 of the world's worst supervillains of all time. Their goal, conquest of the universe. Only one group can stop this intergalactic threat. The Gentleman Nerds. Mark Finn.
Super Strength.
Mickey Finn.
Nigh invulnerable.
And the Texas polar bear, Aaron DiOrive.
Mind control.
I'm Joseph Fotinos, and welcome to the Lobot Lounge and this episode of the Gentleman Nerds. 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 Nerds.
Well done. Way to channel Ted Knight, man.
Thank you very much. Welcome aboard, everyone, to the Lobot Lounge. The gentlemen nerds are gathered, and as you can tell by our opening, we are excited about superheroes today.
Yes, 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 indeed. Just finished binge-watching Jessica Jones, and obviously my choice of superpower very much influenced by that, but I have discovered, and it took Jessica Jones to show me this, that if you have mind control, you pretty much trump everything else. It doesn't matter what your superpower is, that one is pretty much going to be the one that will get you whatever it is that you want, either on the hero or villain side.
Which is the problem.
Yeah.
Now, for those of you who aren't familiar with Jessica Jones, Aaron is referring to the heavy in the series, not Jessica Jones herself. She does not have mind control abilities.
Correct.
He is talking about the Purple Man.
Yes, Kilgrave, also known as the Purple Man.
Right.
For the Marvel Universe, we are talking Marvel at this point.
Yes. And for those of you who have just seen the show and don't know anything about the comics, he was actually only known as the Purple Man for a while, which is why he wears the purple suits in the show.
And I think Jessica Jones thematically follows closely, in fact, even takes place in the same Hell's Kitchen as the Daredevil Netflix series.
Despite lacking of any mention. Yes.
Right. That's what I was wondering about that. How come they didn't mention
the Daredevil? We had a crossover character, but that's it.
Right.
Yeah. Well, she mentions him. I mean, in the episode,
the newscasts and everything, they had a perfect opportunity and they didn't do it.
Correct.
I'm okay with that.
I think for purposes of just leaving the two shows, for now, putting the two shows apart, they wanted to focus on Jessica Jones, and so I understand that decision.
Yeah, we're going to have Iron Fist in the future. I'm sure that'll show on Daredevil.
Yes.
And Luke Cage. Oh, my God, how can they... I think it's too many shows, quite frankly, but...
Well, now, thematically, again, we're talking about the Marvel Universe, and the Marvel Universe, if you really want to talk about its renaissance in the recent years, let's start with our good friend Iron Man on the big screen, and, of course, the cinematic Marvel Universe that has been building and adding to and just amazingly, and some misfires here and there, but for the most part, I think they're doing a fantastic job. On the small screen, Jessica Jones, Daredevil, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., can we think of anything else Marvel-wise?
Oh, my favorite one, Carter, Agent
Carter.
Good stuff there. So the difference between the movies and television, obviously, you'd think they could show more on the movies than they could on TV. But for Netflix, though, they do go a little bit darker
right.
with this stuff.
A little.
A little. Well, there's a little bit more sex. There's a little bit more violence. There's a little bit more darkness in terms of mood and tone. What do you guys think in terms of can you sustain an audience that way?
I'll tell you. I think that Marvel has a huge advantage right now over DC in that they have figured out how to do their movies. DC is still trying to figure out what they're going to do.
Yeah, because the tone of the next Superman versus Batman movie is completely different from Man of Steel.
They also don't have a unified fan base. For every person who says, finally a Superman story I can get behind, there's another fan walking away in disgust. So they've only got half the audience. Whereas everybody is more or less on board for the Marvel stuff. And so Marvel's world building has largely taken place on the big screen. They're just now starting to supplement some of that with Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., which they have actually managed to do, I think, a really good job of being a separate but equal entity with a big storyline leading right up into the May movie, and then the fallout from that, you know, being where they pick up with the next season. Pretty smart idea. So what we're seeing here with the Netflix is a chance for them to try to claim some of the ground that DC has claimed, or I should say Warner Television has claimed, because they don't have, aside from S.H.I.E.L.D., which is not super dark. It's certainly got some grim moments, and it's certainly got some sobering moments. There's been a pretty high body count this season.
Yeah.
But with the Netflix shows, they get a chance to do two things. They get to develop some of these smaller characters. Small is the wrong word. Let's call them second-tier characters, for lack of a better phrase. They get to develop those into a sort of standalone scenario, and they get to build the dark parts of the world. Right now, all the cinematic stuff is kind of dealing with the high points. We don't really have a sense of the low points, and it really wasn't until Daredevil that they mentioned how much damage was done to New York City. There might have been a piece of dialogue in S.H.I.E.L.D. about it, but S.H.I.E.L.D.'s had their own stuff to deal with. They're still kind of a frontline thing. So hearing that Hell's Kitchen was devastated, and in the confusion, all of the organized crime is sort of disorganized, and now here comes a guy trying to reorganize it. As usual, they've done a really good job of telescoping their very complicated history and boiling it down to some essential elements that we can all sort of get behind without being...
I would argue without that darkness, without that noir feel that they're developing on Netflix, I actually don't know that they would be as successful on television. I think S.H.I.E.L.D. does what it does very well, but I think the Daredevil story, certainly the Jessica Jones story, it sounds like all of those set in Hell's Kitchen with the street crime level heroes needed a dark Netflix adult kind of a scenario. Without that, these characters would be watered down.
Right.
And I think they'd be far less interesting. So I think it's this wonderful confluence of the format meeting the medium, meeting the distributor, meeting the tone, I mean, and the hunger from the audience. It really is hitting a perfect nexus.
But it is Netflix, and my counter to all that would be that it's not as widespread as ABC's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., and it doesn't have the exposure that these larger pieces do. I'm going to jump on DC's bandwagon simply because I would consider myself DC before Marvel, although I like them both, but I would consider myself DC before Marvel. DC on the small screen, on the other hand, has done everything right. Flash, Arrow, Supergirl to a certain extent, although they're getting better with that. And now the new Heroes of Tomorrow, or the Legends of Tomorrow, banded together supervillains and superheroes to go and face Vandal Savage.
Oh,
are you kidding
me? I know.
Vandal freaking Savage on TV? you know, I'm stunned. Flash actually had two brilliant episodes that featured, yes it did, Gorilla Grodd.
I know.
Yeah.
And I saw the previews for that and immediately thought Mark.
Oh.
They were so well done. And I'm saying that here, the age that we live in, I'm watching a TV show, and there is a fully realized, both animatronic and CG, Gorilla Grodd talking, attacking, roaring, moving, Grodd. And it's breathtakingly gorgeous. I think DC is doing everything right on the small screen. And like Mark said, on the big screen, they are playing a game of catch-up, and they just don't know where to go.
Yeah, it's the DC universe on TV. Now, they floundered because, you know, TV executives are a superstitious and cowardly lot, and they do not take a risk. Smallville was very successful for 10 seasons as Smallville 90210.
Even Lois and Clark, I think, followed a lot of that same.
Absolutely.
For the first few seasons, it was very successful.
So there's a really sharp learning curve on Arrow. For those of you who have heard a lot about the series, let me tell you what to do. I know it's going to seem counterproductive, and a lot of fans will tell you not to do this. Skip the first season of Arrow. just read the synopses, honestly, because it is dark and it's moody and it's a massive soap opera.
It really is. I would counter that by saying that watching his change, watching his development is important. So by the time he reaches the end where he says, all right, I'm not going to fire my arrows into someone's heart anymore. I'm actually going to be a hero and not take lives. It means more. If you saw where he came from.
Every author I know who is a fan of that show, talking to other people, is like, you don't really want to see first season because, but all the stuff on the island is important. And I still haven't seen it yet.
The stuff on the island is certainly important initially because it does speak to character. But I don't think that show gets really interesting until season two when they do in the middle of Grimdark, Starling City, the Flash's origin story.
Mm-hmm.
Holy smoke! Right. And so that's the point at which I went, wait a second.
Right.
We've really got something there, because prior to that, honestly, the first season of Arrow looks like a show from 1994. Mm-hmm. It looks like mm-hmm. Birds of Prey. They've changed the name of everybody.
Vampire the Embrace.
Inexplicably, you know, nobody's got quite the same name, but we're going to call his sister. His sister? Yeah, his sister. We're going to call his sister Speedy. Get it? See, it's an Easter egg. You geeks like Easter eggs, right? So we put an Easter egg in there.
And then we're going to add something more where she gets hooked on a drug. Get it?
Yeah, the whole thing feels like, you know, you're pandering to man children. And I found the whole thing really insulting.
However, speaking of dark DC, a show we have not mentioned, which I've become quite a fan of, is Gotham.
Yes,
The first, again, as with almost every show that I can think of, the first season of Gotham, it's trying to find its legs. It's trying to find its tone. It's trying to, are we going to be a serious, you know, police procedural? Are we going to be a goofy comic book world? And I think they've hit that stride, certainly in this second season.
Yeah.
They have hit the stride. And it is dark in a way that Arrow only wishes it could be.
But still, somehow buoyant comes from the performances of Robin Lord Taylor as Cobblepot and Enigma and these characters that we know, and we grin because we're like, I know where this is going.
Yeah.
I know where you are going. So when, again, Cobblepot is so over the top, he's brilliant.
Right.
I mean,
and somebody had mentioned that it is set in a Burton-esque kind of world, and I agree with that.
Yeah.
I mean, a good Burton-esque kind of world.
I swear, the office that they used, the set of the office that they used for the last storyline where they had the evil politician who was trying, that office, it was Grissom's office from the original Batman.
Mm.
The window view, the faces,
it,
the smoke, the desk.
Certainly, and if nothing else, the architecture
it
was very much inspired.
Like Grissom's office.
Yes, no, you're right. But we watch that. The family watches that. You know, we watch Flash, and we love Flash, and we love Gorilla Grodd, and we love all the characters in there. Cisco is my favorite. But then we watch Gotham, and Elena, my 11-year-old daughter, will sit close to Blythe with her hands close to her eyes because it freaks her out. You know, she knows at any moment one of these dangerous villains on Gotham is going to pull out a knife and slice somebody's throat, and it's going to be bloody and gory and very, very brutal right there. You see it all. And I'm like, wow, they're doing this on network TV. How are they getting away with it?
Because they've got the showrunner of The Mentalist and Rome running this thing.
Mm, yeah.
He is a really good storyteller, so, and he
I'm
can
real,
pull things off.
I'm glad you guys like the show. I am going to be the lone voice of contrition for Gotham. I'm not a fan. And it has nothing to do with tone, because clearly the darkness doesn't bother me. I love Jessica Jones and thought Daredevil was great. And I still think the second Chris Nolan Dark Knight movie is probably the best Batman we'll ever see on the silver screen. But my problem with it is the premise. I originally thought that this was going to be a show kind of like S.H.I.E.L.D., more like Ed Brubaker's Gotham City Police Department, meaning here's the police procedural stuff in a world where Batman is running across the rooftops. We're the guys having to pick up his batarangs when they drop out of criminals' necks. And what instead what it is an Elseworlds show where we get to see all of his villains grow up before he does. And I'm unfortunately unable to divorce my fan love of Batman enough to where I can't just quote-unquote go with it. I look at this and go, so let me get this straight. By the time he's 28 and Batman, he's going to be beating on all these middle-aged men who have suddenly become supervillains. And Commissioner Gordon is looking around like, yeah, I don't know who this Joker guy is. Yeah, I think you do. I don't know who this Enigma guy is. Yeah, I think you do. The whole thing hinges on this premise that invalidates 75 years of Batman continuity. Which
now, have you watched this new season, Mark? Or have you
I dropped out okay. When the cutesy right. Catwoman showed up in her little anime outfit.
I would urge you to watch the second season. And the only reason why is because I was starting down that path that you just described, because my love for Batman is great. But once I realized that it is an Elseworlds show and that it is talking about characters, because that's my pet peeve with people who there is somebody online and that we all know, a fellow writer who hates everything, especially this show. I won't mention his name. But my pet peeve about his complaint with the show and Batman is that it is impossible for this individual to imagine a Gotham City, to imagine a rogues gallery that exists without Batman. Whereas
right.
I have no trouble. It is almost to me too comic booky and ridiculous to think that these characters, Riddler, Joker, Penguin, Mr. Freeze, Catwoman, had no existence up until Batman showed up. Then suddenly they all, spontaneously, from the forehead of Zeus.
There was a theory put forward that at least I think Paul Dini did it very well in the animated series. There was a question that said, if it wasn't for you, Batman, would these people be here? Would they be in the state they
right.
are? They're in. One could very much argue that, you know, whoever the Joker is, we don't know, folks, it's not Jack Napier, whoever the Joker is, it was Batman's fault, maybe, maybe not, but depending on how you look at it, if you want to have a history, I want it to be multiple choice, where he tumbles into the vat. It's Batman's fault that he didn't stop Boss Maroni from tossing acid into Harvey Dent's face. It's Batman's fault that Nora Freeze had to be, you know, encased you could sit there and go down the list and go, well, Batman was involved in that too. Shit. Batman was involved in that too. Wow. That's...
No, but I guess for me, I don't have a problem imagining that the Penguin had a long history long before he ever even heard of Batman.
Right, right. Now that I agree. I hear what you're saying, and I like the idea of an organic Gotham City that's rife with all these strange elements, and that also allows it's the type of thing, you know, if you're a criminal operating in a world where the Penguin has a piece of the underground, and there's this guy named, you know, the Scarecrow wandering the streets and it's already kind of weird. A guy showing up in a turtleneck with a G.I. Joe Escape from Spy Island outfit on isn't going to inspire fear. You need to be weirder than the guys that they're already afraid of. I see where this goes, and it does sort of reshape the Batman origin, and I am certainly big enough to allow for that.
Right.
But I have a problem in movies. I have a real problem with magical children, and I really have a problem with a Bruce Wayne that's helpless. And so I understand that Alfred is sort of his conciliary, you know.
He is, but again, this is why I urge you to watch it.
Right,
Bruce Wayne
He's
does things this season that had all three of us sitting on the couch watching this going, yeah, you know, that is the kid that's going to be back.
All right, I'll make you a deal. I will watch the first three episodes of season two just for you.
Okay.
Because I care.
Okay. Okay.
We're dwelling in darkness here, and because that's what we're talking about. You got your noir in my superhero. I like to go on record as saying that I prefer my superheroes a little less dark.
Yes.
Now, villains? Sure, let them go down that path because that's why they're villains. But I don't want, and Mark and Mickey and Aaron, you guys are obviously big Batman fans. I like The Dark Knight as well, but count me as a Superman fan. Uh-huh. I am absolutely 100% the Man of Tomorrow's biggest fan.
I've never actually liked Superman until Henry Cavill came along.
Oh, yes.
Okay.
We're not talking about the pseudo-comedy, big theatrical thing, Christopher Reeve. I just mean Superman in general.
Oh, well, I'm talking about Superman in general in terms of what he represents.
Sure.
And how he is literally the Superman. With your kind indulgence, I'm going to go down a little bit of a rabbit hole and just say that if there's any superhero that I would like my son to emulate, it's the Man of Steel. Because look what he can do. Look what he is able to do and chooses not to. This is a man who can bend steel in his bare hands, change the course of mighty rivers, but he stops to help a kitten out of a tree. That's Superman. He is hope. He is a symbol. He is bright. He is not dark. There's nothing dark about Superman. We don't want him dark. We want him to be the big Boy Scout. Think of this. Think of those firefighters running up the stairs on 9/11.
Right.
Think of the most handsome, good-looking, athletic boy in school who could be mean and cruel to the nerds and yet joins them at their table because he's good. He's a good man. That is Superman. He's those people, and he gives us the best of who we are.
Yeah.
What he does in Metropolis and in the planet and in the galaxy is huge. But
right.
At the same time, he's so humble because he was raised by Jonathan and Martha. He knows that he loves a good hamburger. He loves a good apple pie. He's proud to be a human, considered to be a human, and he's proud to be an American. Gosh darn it. Truth, justice, and the American way, that's Superman. Don't mess with him. The formula works.
Yeah. And a lot of people got down on Man of Steel for messing with that.
Yeah.
But to me, and I'm not saying, Man of Steel, best movie ever, but to me, the fact that he went through that and is coming out the other side to be the Superman gives more meaning to it because he's not just not automatically a Boy Scout.
I get the impression from the upcoming movie that we're going to back up a little bit and witness that slap fight that happened at the end of Man of Steel, all of the disaster porn, and Bruce Wayne, upon seeing Superman and Zod flying through buildings owned by him,
yes,
and people falling and dying, is going to decide that this guy needs a check.
Yes.
And I get the impression that that's what this movie's going to be about.
And
now,
a lot of people are going to be like, what the hell are you talking about? But from what I've seen from Ben Affleck, this may be one of my favorite performances for Bruce Wayne.
I have no problem with Affleck as Bruce Wayne.
The reason I'm going there is because my favorite version of Bruce Wayne is from Batman Beyond.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the closest I've seen to that.
Yeah,
the old guy, yeah. Well, here's the thing. I was on the camp of I didn't like Man of Steel. I mean, I liked a lot of it, but overall I was unhappy with the portrayal of Superman. But now, as Mickey said, now that I see what they're doing, now I understand where that was leading up to. And by the way, that might be totally revisionist history. They might have gone, oops, well, we didn't quite hit the right tone with Man of Steel, but hey, you know what? We can fix it.
Yeah.
Here's Batman versus Superman, and now we're going to explain why all that stuff happened.
And that's perfectly good storytelling.
Exactly, and count me converted. I absolutely agree that Batman exists in the form, because he is Frank Miller's, there's been no bones about it. He is Frank Miller's Dark Knight Batman in this movie. And he exists for the sole purpose of saying this guy is a dangerous alien, a force that cannot be controlled, that can easily destroy us. We must put him down. And it is when he sees, it is when Batman sees, and I think Wonder Woman is going to be a crucial catalyst to that happening. I can't wait to see her. I think it's when he sees that goodness that Joseph was just talking about, that's when Bruce Wayne says, oh my God, I get it.
Well, I don't have a problem with any of that. I'd have problems, and again, this is me aesthetically nitpicking. I have a problem with their costumes. I have a problem with the dark colors. I have a problem with Lex Luthor being an annoying turd burger.
Yeah.
Well, my dream Lex Luthor, just shave Clancy Brown's head.
But it's got to be Clancy Brown circa 1985, like Buckaroo Banzai Clancy.
Yeah.
Wouldn't he be brilliant?
Yeah. I agree. This Lex Luthor, it is not working for me. It is not working for me.
It is his son.
It is?
Yes.
I'm going to give them this movie. They've said wait and see. I am on record and have a massive denunciation of Superman on my blog that a lot of people went, yeah, I really can't argue with that. And certainly I wasn't the only one to massively denounce Man of Steel. But they said wait and see, and I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt, even though Snyder has absolutely no credit with me. He made one good superhero movie. And it's a good movie because it needed a story, and he gave 300 just enough of an extra kick to make all of those storyboards that Frank Miller drew work. And he has divided the room with every other project he's ever done.
I liked his version of Watchmen.
And I didn't. And,
because
and,
what
and,
got cut, I thought needed to get cut. So
my thing is what he really should have done is rewritten the movie. But if you rewrite the comic into a movie, you lose the fans who said he didn't do a classic adaptation. With Watchmen, he was damned if he did and damned if he didn't.
However, one thing I will thank him for, despite the movie he did afterwards, was he gave likable female characters, which is something that seems impossible in the original comic.
I'm very excited about Wonder Woman. When Wonder Woman dropped down in the little Batman Superman preview and they both asked, I thought she was with you.
That's an entrance.
I got super excited, and I probably
She's going to be. I believe she will be the linchpin. She's going to be absolutely instrumental to bringing the Justice League together.
Oh, right.
But again, like you, Mark, I am cautious. I am optimistic, but I'm very, very cautious because I walked into Man of Steel wanting to feel coming out of it like I did when I walked out of the Christopher Reeve Superman, and I didn't.
Yeah,
I was not happy. Yeah. I was just relieved the good guys won.
Yeah.
And a Superman movie should not just have me relieved the good guys won. It should have me walk out feeling hopeful and good and looking up at the sky and saying, man, I wish he was real, you know?
Right. And for goodness sakes, just take him out of town. I mean, he punched him into the stratosphere and punched him right back into the pawn of the planet exactly where he punched him out. Take him off. Take him somewhere else, for goodness sakes.
Yeah.
I mean, it just, it's
logical. But again, if they were doing that to set up Batman versus Superman without that destruction.
Well, as far as Wonder Woman goes, she's got some work to do as far as I'm concerned. I'm not convinced that this is a Wonder Woman that's going to be anything special. First of all, I think the casting is all wrong. I think she's a tiny little girl, and Wonder Woman needs to be an amazingly large Amazon woman. She's Gal Gadot, I think her name is.
Yeah.
She's beautiful. But she's tiny.
Yeah, I think she looks fine.
I think Wonder Woman needs to be Linda Carter. I mean, she needs to be big and strong and believably powerful.
Yeah, she doesn't look necessarily Amazonian. I'll give you that.
Plus, there has to be a motherly nature to her, that she has that Earth Mother feel to her. Wonder Woman is, as amazing as she is, just like Superman, she's all about the sisters and the little girls and the children. She's got that protective vibe to her. Yes, she's a warrior, but there's also a warmth to her that makes people go to Wonder Woman.
Let's see where they go with that. I mean, I love the fact that, you know, Batman's about to get fried, and she jumps in the way and blocks, with her shield, blocks that beam from Doomsday.
Oh, that was Doomsday? I thought that was the Abomination.
No, Doomsday looks just like, it looks like a cave troll from Lord of the Rings or one of the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. But anyway, we'll talk about that horrible design in a minute.
I'm hoping that he grows spines and spikes as the movie goes on.
Yeah.
That's the only thing I can
Lord, yeah, he does kind of look like an angry potato.
There is a possibility that they're going to digitally manipulate her a little bit so that she's larger. I mean, that's certainly, you know, you could film her to look larger by just framing her in shots a certain way.
Sure.
But,
Lord of the Rings all day long.
I actually dig. I dig when it shows Bruce Wayne and you know, Clark Kent standing next to each other. Bruce Wayne is so much bigger than Clark because he can be. Clark doesn't have to be a big guy. He's an alien. He could be as scrawny as the Lex Luthor character, and he could still punch through miles of concrete. So I actually like that Batman has to be a big, physically imposing guy because he's just a normal human who's tough as hell. But Superman doesn't. Superman does not have to be a big, tough, imposing guy.
It'll be interesting to see how this whole thing develops, but I want to go back to the Berlanti verse for just a minute. I think what Greg Berlanti is doing, what he has done, is nothing short of brilliant. You know, there was this it's been apocryphally stated that Berlanti was trying to sell a Batman series initially. And they said, we've got plans for Batman, you can't have him. And he said, oh, okay, then how about Green Arrow? And they went, yeah, you can do Green Arrow. And so he said, okay, let me just file all the serial numbers off of my Batman pitch.
I heard that as
and
well.
And so I think now that when Flash came out and was sort of like that watershed moment, you know, like, oh, so it is okay if we do superheroes.
Oh, yeah.
They've now really ratcheted up, and every episode of both shows is indulging in significant world building.
Yeah.
I mean, they're popping characters off like somebody dumped water on Gizmo after midnight. You know, they're just, you know, just characters are flying off left and right. Massive concepts. I can't believe, Joseph, you know, you mentioned Grodd, and I agree with you. I mean, what an age of miracles and wonders we live in when I can see Gorilla Grodd fight Flash on TV in live action. But then to go from the season finale to an explanation of episode of season two, where we're talking about Earth 2 and multiverses.
And he even uses the term. Let's call it Earth 2. And then the little fanboy me was like, yes, let's call it Earth 2.
Yeah, let's do that.
Let's do that. I like that. Let's stick with that.
I think that'll catch on.
Wasn't that a Clancy Brown show at one point?
Well, and so, but the thing is, you know, this now opens up, you know, what, and of course, I think what they're probably going to do is the second we start seeing characters on the big screen who have TV counterparts, they can just simply go multiverse.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's very true. It's very true. And again, they're not shying away from the fantastic, which is what I think it needs to do. What I think Marvel does it really well. They didn't have a broken anything. I mean, they didn't have to fix anything. They basically said, you want Iron Man? Here's Iron Man. You want the Hulk? Here's the Hulk. You want a talking raccoon and a giant tree that walks and talks? Here they are. They're not shying away from it. Whereas I think DC tends to go, well, let's go gritty and real. The Joker doesn't have to have his skin bleached. Let's just have him put makeup on and have these scars on his face. Yeah, that's realistic. Yeah,
it's their only style option. But I like Marvel's take on this. I think it was Feig who has said probably in a couple of places now, you know, what we're doing is we're not making superhero movies. We're making genre movies that happen to have superheroes in them. Mm-hmm. You know, and you can say the same thing of the television shows. And in fact, if you look on Netflix at how Daredevil is listed, it's listed as a crime drama.
Yeah.
Right? And certainly it is. I mean, right up until the point that Daredevil gets a suit and from the Gladiator, and he can now stop bullets, and, you know, right up until then, it's pretty much a crime drama. Same thing with Jessica Jones. I mean, yeah, she's got super strength and he's got mind control, but the whole thing is a psychological drama. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's the smart way to play it. And it certainly has worked for Marvel, where the tone of these books is so different. DC trying to do a unified theory, and they're playing with these larger icons. This is the problem with Superman and Batman and Wonder Woman, this need to go back and reexamine the origin. Everything's got to be epic and massive and so strong. And I just don't know that, you know, what Marvel was always good at, what Marvel was always better than DC at in the comics, were those quiet moments. Yeah, they had Galactus. Yeah, they had Ego, the Living Planet. And yeah, somebody was always trying to pull Manhattan off of the Earth and put it into space. But comics would open or close, or sometimes even be all just about the Torch and Spider-Man eating donuts on top of the Statue of Liberty and talking about their girlfriends, or Captain America and Thing and Nick Fury having coffee and swapping war stories the old men, you know, in the delis. Yeah. There was always these quiet moments that and Marvel movies have even managed to pull that in, you know, very well. Mm-hmm. DC has always been more about earth-shaking cataclysms, and they're...
Well, they're more black and white, aren't they? I mean, DC actually is the good guys and the bad guys, and there's never a question in the classic right. Golden Age who was who. Marvel, their heroes were flawed. They had to pay rent. They had troubles with their girlfriends. They got sick. Yeah. I distinctly remember a series of Spider-Man episodes where he literally got sick.
Oh, yeah, and it affected his powers, yeah.
Yeah, he got a cold. And he just, I'm like, superhero got sick? He can't do it because he got sick? And the Hobgoblin was kicking his butt. And he was like, I feel terrible because I can't, and here's the Hobgoblin who just took his super serum or whatever. He's tossing dumpsters at him. And he's like, oh, great, I don't feel up to this right now. You know, we all have those days. We all just don't feel up to it.
Yeah. Well, they also had a number of characters who would start out villains and become heroes. And so you're right. There was always a sliding scale to the Marvel Universe.
Yeah, I mean, Wolverine started out as a villain originally, didn't he?
Well, he started out as an antagonist.
An annoyance.
A foil.
He was certainly a foil. But when he appeared, he's a Canadian agent.
Right.
So this one note, Grimdark, that DC has been trying to do may be an abortive attempt at trying to get that sort of middle ground that Marvel has always had a good job of maintaining. And again, what I think happens is you split the fan base. The 50% that love it are the guys who consider themselves Marvel fans. The 50% that don't love it are the guys who go, I'm a DC guy.
I would think more 70-30, quite frankly. I mean, if you're getting percentages, the classic DC, the one that matters, quite frankly, the one before the New 52, the one that actually goes, oh, yeah, all that history, all that beautiful built-up history that DC had, the rich, delicious, good and bad, delightful Superman-Batman banter. One of my favorite Superman storylines before the New 52 was Grounded, and in it, Superman just walks. He walks across the country and helps people. That's what he does. And people were complaining about it. He's not fighting anybody. He's not hitting nothing. No, he's not. But just read it.
Yeah.
He does there's a beautiful sequence where there's a jumper on a roof. And he floats up and he just stands in front of her. And she's like, I'm going to jump. He's like, I'm not going to stop you. I'm just going to be here. I'm going to be right here. No. You're like them. Everything's wrong. That's okay. I understand. We all feel bad. I'm going to be right here. And then the next panel shows him still floating there. And the sun's going down, and the next panel shows it's dark now. He's still floating there. She's on the ledge, and then the spotlight comes on from the cops, and she's like, the light's hurting my eyes. And he looks down, and he blasts it with his supervision, turns the light off, and he just floats there. Now, mind you, he just did an amazing amount of damage to this light and probably cost the city thousands of dollars, but I'm sure he's going to fix that. But in the end, when she stands up and takes his hand and he hugs her and they're floating in the sky, I'm like, that's Superman.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. That's the man who cares about the smallest of us. It's not about punching Zod through buildings and not caring people are falling into their deaths. It's just not Superman, which is why I have a huge inherent problem with Man of Steel. Love Cavill, though. Think he's a beautiful man.
Yeah. And by the way, I think they're achieving some level of that personal note that you were talking about, Mark, with Flash. I mean, we are as interested in what's happening with Barry as we are with what's happening with the Flash.
Definitely.
You know, Barry and his relationship with his father and his relationship with Irene and the friendships that he develops with Cisco. I mean, it's they've done such a great... There are several moments in that show, in Flash, where we have been brought to tears. In the human moments, in him reaching out to his foster father and them hugging each other and, you know, you're my son and you're my dad. And wow, I'm just like, holy cow, they're real people. They're real people with real emotions. And now there's a supervillain. He's got to go fight him. But I love it's those quiet moments that have really won us over in Flash.
Yes.
And not the big super fancy. We love the heroics, but without that human stuff, it's they're empty. They don't really mean anything.
Well, that's I lost my narrative thread when I started Marcologging, but yeah, that's the point I was trying to make. Is Berlanti has actually been able to pull that off,
in
a way that the movies have not, and by the sheer virtue of the amount of world building he's been able to do with these two shows, he's on track to be the player to beat.
Yeah, I agree. No, he's not. But this is why I'm telling you. I think that the DC shows have hit a certain tone that most DC fans are comfortable with and they like, even the darkness of Arrow. And this is why Netflix, with shows like Daredevil and Jessica Jones, and we'll see with Iron Fist and Luke Cage, but it feels like a Frank Miller world.
Yes.
It has that Marvel early 80s feel to it. And so I think that's where they're both finding their stride. They're both finding their stride and hitting their target audience. I think this is why we're in this renaissance of superhero shows that we currently find ourselves in. And by the way, speaking of humanizing people, I wanted to jump really quick and say one of my favorite all-time stories set in Superman is not actually about Superman. It's about Lex Luthor. And it was during John Byrne's stint, and I know people have issues with John Byrne, but he certainly can write some good stuff and has. And my favorite was the Lex Luthor portrayed in that, who was the sort of corrupt billionaire industrialist kind of guy, is driving out with his Mercedes, whoever it is, out to some little podunk town outside of Metropolis. And he goes into a diner, he encounters a waitress. And he starts talking to this waitress and talking about the life he could offer her if she came to work for him, and all of her broken dreams growing up in this place, and she's never going to achieve anything, and you know she's going to marry the first guy that knocks her up, and she's never going to amount to anything, and with him she'll travel the world and she'll see so many things and learn so much, and he seduces her. And then says, this is the opportunity. Walk away from your life. Walk away from all of this. I'll be waiting outside in my limousine, and I'll bring you into this new life. And he goes out into the car, and she's sitting there in several panels of her looking around the diner and looking at the patrons, many of the people she grew up with, and finally going into the back and ripping off her uniform and racing outside, and there's no one in the parking lot. And they're driving off, and Mercedes is saying, so, you know, you had us wait longer than usual this time, Mr. Luthor. And he goes, oh, yes, I wanted to see how long it would take, you know. I wanted to give this one a little more time or whatever. And I just thought, up to that point, I've never hated a villain, a comic book villain. And I thought, oh, you despicable son of a bitch.
Yeah.
And suddenly I hated this guy. You know, there's been villains that have been plotted, the death of millions and blown up cities. But no, in that moment, I hated that guy.
It reminds me of a short story that was in a collection called The Greatest Joker Stories Ever Told. It came out right after the first Tim Burton Batman. And there was a short story, and I can't remember the author. I apologize. I'll have to look this up later for notes. But the Joker was on the lam. He was hiding out in a hotel, and he was bored, and he was watching late-night free TV on the cable while he was hiding from Batman. And he sees this helpline called Suicide Helpline. So he picks up the phone, and he calls the helpline. And whoever answers the phone, it was like a chat line. So he's talking to this woman on the phone, this girl, and he instantly knows everything about her the minute she says hello in her timid little voice. And he just starts talking to her on this chat line, and they're supposed to be helping each other, and he's manipulating her all the way to where he gets her to go ahead and just pull the trigger. It's okay. It's not worth it. It's not worth it.
Wow.
You know? It's brilliant, because she comes back at him and says, you know what? You're a mean person. I got on this helpline because I wanted to find some hope, some connection, some other human being. And you know what? You're horrible, and you're always going to be alone, and no one's ever going to love you. Thank you. You've made me feel better about myself. And she hangs up on him, and he sits there for a few minutes, and he takes the gun that he's been carrying, walking around with, puts it to his own head, and pulls the trigger, and it's the bang gun, you know, the little thing that goes, it says bang, and he starts laughing, and that's how the story ends. But it's brilliant that that's how he passes his time.
Wow.
Like Luke.
Yeah, no, it is important. For all of these incredibly godlike characters, you know, it is ultimately, I mean, it sounds cliche, but it is the humanity that draws us, that brings us into their world, that makes us comfortable with them, that makes us want to spend, you know, hour after hour after hour watching them and seeing what they do. It's a power fantasy. Yes, everybody wants to have those abilities and fly around and, you know, do whatever they do, but it for us as the audience, that is what draws us in, is their humanity. They're mm-hmm. absolute, and it's almost like they're more human for being so powerful.
Right.
They're more mm-hmm. flawed for having these amazing abilities.
And actually, we've been talking a lot about DC and Marvel, but I want to delve a little bit into the independents that have been adapted for the small screen.
Okay.
And that ties in to a personal favorite of my wife's and I's that Aaron is like, I tried it and nobody else has ever seen it, called Powers. It's on the PlayStation Network, and it's done by the same guy who did Jessica Jones, and it has the concept of the unpowered police force that has to deal with all these people suddenly mm-hmm. turning into what they consider heroes or villains, and the police just consider them all a nuisance. Mm-hmm. And it's got that humanity aspect to it with some, horrible budget. The flying effects are, ugh.
And that's the thing. To be fair, I wasn't a fan of the series. I actually liked the comic.
Yeah, I didn't know you'd read the comic.
No, I have, and that's why I watched the series, because I started picking up, you know, I like Bendis, I think he's a good writer, I saw that he was doing Powers, and I thought, let me check this out, and I very much enjoyed the comic, but wow, I watched the first episode of that on the PlayStation, and I was like, no, I don't think so.
Oh, you only watched the first episode?
I did.
I always warn people going into it, the first 15 minutes looks like a bad early 90s cop drama on syndication.
It's
horrible.
Really, really horrible.
It is one of those things that needs an episode or two to get its feet underneath it.
Right.
For one thing, you don't get very much Michelle Forbes or Eddie Izzard in the first episode. You do get some Noah Taylor, and he's awesome. He's the one playing Johnny Royale.
Cool. Okay.
And then you of course, have Tuesday Kate or Charto Copley. But Charto Copley plays the guy who's ostensibly the main character who used to have powers and lost them. And there's actually a line in the thing that says, I lost my power, so they gave me a badge. What the am I supposed to do with that?
Right. No, I like the comic.
Yeah.
I think the comic was fun and entertaining, and I could not. There's no way. There's only so many hours in a day.
And then the other two independents that actually had a lot more success. Well, theoretically had a lot more success. Did anybody see The Middleman?
Nope.
No.
Oh, highly recommend going out and grabbing The Middleman.
Is it a TV series?
Yes, it was a TV series on ABC Family, which is a very strange place to put it. It only lasted 12 episodes before it got pulled. It is very much what the live-action Tick should have been.
Oh, okay.
It's sort of Men in Black meets superheroes. And it is a lot of fun. It's highly quotable. The creator has gone on to do a lot of stuff. Currently working on The 100. And he did some, he did some Lost. He did, stuff like that.
Did I hear you say it was pulled?
It only made it 12 episodes, but you can get the details.
It got canceled. Okay.
Yeah. You know, there's a theme going on.
So what was
here,
another? Hold on. There was another one you mentioned, Mickey. You said there was two more. The Middleman and what was
the animated? The live action.
Gotcha.
The animated Tick was amazing. Cheerface Chippendale, absolutely one of my favorite villains of all time. Really. That's just ridiculous. And what was the trying to write his name on the moon?
Yeah.
And they stopped it, but it just still said Chop.
For the whole rest of the series.
For the whole rest of the series, the moon always said Chop.
Yeah. Really.
Well, we won. But the theme that we have here, I think, guys, is besides the darkness that's prevalent in our superheroes and our TV and our movies, and especially with the villains, but I have a problem with it when it goes into the heroes, but we've already talked about that. I think what I'm hearing is, if you're starting a new series, you have to give it some time. You can't give up on it. The theme tonight has been, you didn't like that? Yeah, well, give it another shot. Or you didn't watch more than one episode? Give it another shot.
Yeah.
Don't watch the first season. Start with the second season.
Yeah.
It's like you have to let them get its legs under themselves. And I think that's just storytelling, isn't it? I mean, we're skipping the first part because they're walking on shaky legs like a baby. But once they start getting stronger and they start getting their stride, well, this is what you want to do.
Yeah, it's the supernatural effect where the first several episodes bear no relation to the rest of the first 5 years. So,
and I think Buffy falls into that too. Buffy.
Oh yeah.
Most quality shows.
Yeah.
I mean, heck, I got like three episodes into Jessica Jones, and I wasn't sure I was going to finish the series.
Yeah.
It just was not. It was not appealing to me.
Yeah, the first episode seemed like they were trying a little too hard.
Well, the Hell's Kitchen stories, I think that probably fits because especially Daredevil, we all know who's coming next season.
Right.
Mr. Castle's going to show up, and that's going to be a whole other level of dark.
And Elektra.
and Elektra, and what's his name?
Bullseye.
Bullseye, thank you.
That's who I thought Bullseye was going to be the main villain. They're bringing the Punisher's going to be the main villain?
Wow. Well, not actually a villain. But
they might actually end up teaming up.
Possibly. He's still a killer. Okay. He's still a murderer. Okay. And the level of Frank Castle's psychosis is going to be interesting to see how well they're going to go into that. Is he going to be a war journal Punisher? Is he going to have a little assistant? Is he going to be by himself? Is he going to be living in the sewer like a homeless man, you know, doing horrible things to people?
Well,
we don't know where he's going to go with it.
DeWinter, the guy that built that show, is the same guy that did the Spartacus series for Starz. And
those are wonderfully lurid and just violent and wonderful.
They're super over the top.
We've watched every single one.
But what he's really interested in doing is, believe it or not, villain development. Every season of Spartacus goes into great detail about who the main antagonist is and why he's the way he is. And you find yourself every season, if not outright rooting for the bad guy that Spartacus is opposing, you find yourself at least going, yeah, all right, that I could see him going that way. And the same exact thing happens in Daredevil.
Yes.
Right
this,
up until
this
point,
was more interesting to me than the others, although I adored the others.
You spend a lot of time with seeing how Fisk is trying to, you know, basically wrest order out of the chaos. And there's an any means necessary vibe to it, and you're really sympathetic. If not, you're not on his side, but you're at least sympathetic. And you're like, oh, that makes sense. Oh, I get it now.
And
oh,
the final monologue is just fantastic.
And right about the time that he says to Daredevil, "Take your shot," and then all of a sudden the Kingpin shows up, and you go, "Oh, that's right. He's the bad guy, and he's going to kill our hero." Then it becomes that's a wonderful moment to watch because you got to play along, and he kind of tricked you. So I think he's going to do a really good job of giving us a nuanced Castle, and he's definitely going to play up the family tragedy. And that'll be a big part of it. In fact, we may literally the series may open with that.
Yeah. I mean, that's the crux of Castle. Mm-hmm. You don't have the Punisher without that. How does anyone recover from that? How does anyone recover from seeing their parents gunned down in an alley? How does anyone recover from losing their entire planet?
Yeah,
Clark.
To be fair, he was such a baby. He didn't remember
it.
Oh, I'm sorry. Did your parents get gunned down in an alley? My whole race died. You don't see me moping around, Batman.
I love.
Well, there's the doctor. He moped for a while too.
That's true.
I love the meme of Alfred serving Batman a sandwich, and Batman complains, and he said, "You know what I did? The last person that complained the sandwich. Yes. What? I hired a thug to shoot them in an alley." That's brutal.
All right, gentlemen. The Lobot Lounge has given me the last call sign.
Yes.
Let's do a round of if you don't mind, your absolute favorite adaptation of a superhero, one from movies and one from TV.
All right, very good.
All right, I'm going to do that. Mickey Finn, let's begin with you,
sir. Oh, you're going to start with me on a surprise question. I see how you are. I might have to go with Rorschach for the film.
Okay. So okay, good.
Because Jackie Earle Haley did such a fantastic job.
All right.
Absolutely.
For television, I'm going to go with Jessica Jones.
Okay. Oh, wow. Nice.
Okay.
She has an advantage of being played by Kristen Ritter, who I've always thought is a fantastic actress. So.
Yes. Right. Yes. No, she is very, very good. And Mr. Odiyeve?
Oh gosh. Let's go to Mark. I'm still thinking.
Okay, Mark. Finn.
Okay, I am really enamored right now with Grant Gustin doing the Flash. I like Barry as the Flash. I like the fact that when he's got his cowl on, his head becomes light bulb shaped, which is just like how Carmine Infantino drew him in the Silver Age. He's got this massive bulbous head, and I adore that. So I think he's not doing police scientist Barry Allen, but I think he's got all of the Silver Age drive and verve and innocence, and even though his world is kind of dark, he brings the light, which I think is nice. And so I think TV wise, I think Flash is really firing on all cylinders. Movie wise, I I vacillate back and forth, and my answer will change from day to day. But if since we're talking, well, actually, I'll tell you, Marvel Universe Captain America.
Nice. Very nice.
Marvel Universe Captain America has been spot on from his movie, which was the origin we have only waited 70 years to see, to the way that they're portraying him in the Avengers. I love the little toss-off lines, you know. There's only one God, ma'am, and I'm pretty sure he didn't have a helmet.
Doesn't dress like that.
Before he jumps out of the plane without a parachute. So
Just
perfect distillation of what I would call quintessential Captain America.
And I'll have your back on that due to the fact that I've never been a Captain America fan until he showed up in the movies. And I'm like, oh my God, you made me like Captain America. What is this wizardry?
Now, those are, by the way, those were fantastic choices. You know what? TV-wise, I guess I'm going to have to go with Charlie Cox as Daredevil. He is just, he was everything that Daredevil was during the Miller run.
Yeah.
And it was just brilliant. And I cannot wait for the next season of Daredevil. So that's TV. Movies, just because I've loved this character since I could first read a comic. And I think he is portrayed beautifully in cinema. Chris Hemsworth is Thor. I love Thor. It's my fib. I've never mentioned it before. Over Superman, over everybody, Thor is my favorite character from the world of comics.
And not Odin?
No, not Odin. I look like Odin, but Thor is my favorite character, especially the run of Walt Simonson's run on Thor is brilliant. But I remember back to the old Kirby days.
Yeah.
But absolutely, Thor. Love Thor.
My favorite superhero on TV is 1966 Batman.
Ooh.
Without a doubt.
Bold choice in this day and age.
Exactly, and I'll stand proud and say that I want my superheroes to be superheroes, and I want my villains to be infinitely more watchable than the heroes, which is what they were. The 66 Batman had it all: the brilliant colors, the askewed camera angles, the William Dozier voiceover. You had a Batman who was straight out of "Come on, chum, let's go," the comic books at that era, that time.
Wow.
And you had the Batman and Robin, and they were going to good. You had Commissioner Gordon, who was completely ineffectual. You had an amazing Burgess Meredith Penguin, who until Robin Lord Taylor's Penguin, Burgess Meredith won. He won every single time. He was my Penguin. That's the Penguin. When I did the Penguin character-wise for Halloween and for events, that's the Penguin that I did because he's so much freaking fun to play. The Joker, absolutely over the top. That laugh, Cesar Romero's laugh was the Joker's laugh in my brain when I read Batman comic books and the Joker busted up and started to laugh. It was Cesar Romero's laugh that I heard.
Right.
And Julie Newmar taught me what it was like to be a boy growing into a man. So it was a delightful moment that Julie Newmar.
I'm noticing a trend here in our podcast.
Yeah, buddy.
And I can't not mention Frank Gorshin as the Riddler, who
hands
owned
down.
That. Just owned that role. Such a brilliant performer. He would go back and forth from really dangerously dark and psychotic that 66. He would get quiet and introspective, and he would talk about this. He would explode. He's just amazing performance, and he was so perfect in that. Okay, so there's my TV.
And by the way, just the Riddler in Gotham is fantastic. I love the Riddler in Gotham. Go ahead.
And then for movies, no big surprise, it is Richard Donner's Superman.
Yeah, Christopher Reeve. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. He was the Man of Steel, and he did it so well. I wasn't a big fan of Margot Kidder's Lois Lane, but everything else in there was pretty good.
Yeah.
I would have enjoyed a more sinister Luthor instead of a real estate obsessed villain living in the subway. Yeah. But again, that was perfect for the time period.
It was perfect.
Again, because when he says, real estate, that's his thing. But Superman himself, that when you watch that movie, everything about his performance, the colors, the very first night when he's out and about and that helicopter's dropping and everyone's screaming in terror, and who flies up? This man in this suit, and the pimp that goes woo when he sees him fly up. He says, "Hey man, that's a bad outfit," and he just goes, "Excuse me," and he flies up, and the pimp goes woo. So in my brain, I'm thinking later on that pimp's going to be with his buddies going, I saw this brother. He was wearing this outrageous suit, and the brother flew. He just took off and flew. Yeah. You know? And then he's just so polite. He grabs the helicopter. I got you. Don't worry. Put it down. I think that man needs help. Miss Lane, I hope this doesn't take you away from flying. Still a safe, swift travel. Good night.
Yeah.
Off he goes. Superman.
There's no doubt that Christopher Reeve channeled the spirit of Superman for that movie, because he certainly is my favorite Superman, but brilliant stuff.
Yeah.
And actually, I've got a question for everybody. What comic that has not been adapted would you like to see adapted for a series?
All right.
I want to see this adapted in a stop-motion animated or CGI animated version. Captain Carrot and the Amazing Zoo Crew.
Wow.
I want to see Mark, you know.
I do. We were just talking about it today.
I want to see Pig Iron and Alley Cat Abra. I want to see Captain Carrot.
Those are great names.
In some CGI...
I will not be following you down that rabbit hole. And in equal measure, I will also not be going for Peter Porker, the Spectacular Spider-Man. I just can't.
Spectacular Spider-Man.
I know why you want it. I'm not opposed to you wanting it. I will just never vote for it, okay?
Nice.
This is just where you and I differ, my friend.
I understand. I accept that.
The comic that I would like to see... or the character per se that I'd like to see brought in that they haven't really done yet. With the Berlantiverse, I don't want to sneeze because I'm sure we're going to get everybody by the end of the year, the way they're tossing people left and right. You know, even though we're going to get Gal Gadot in the next movie, I don't think they're ready to do Wonder Woman the right way. And by the right way, I mean my way. I'd like to see a Wonder Woman movie where she has agency and is doing interesting things and fighting off big things that only she can deal with, that's tied into Greek mythology and Ares. And I have the screenplay already if anybody's interested. but so far, my calls have gone unreturned. Don't know why that is.
Strangely.
Weird.
So a true Wonder Woman is your answer.
A solo movie Wonder Woman. She can hold her own. Let's do the origin and then go for it, you know?
Yeah.
And what I mean by that is I'd really like to start her off in World War II.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, no, that's essential.
Yeah,
that is essential.
I think that'd be cool.
Yeah. Mickey?
In my case, I'm a fan of Warren Ellis, and while I'd like to see Transmet done, it's not a superhero story. So I'm going to go with Next Wave. Agents of Hate.
Huh.
If you haven't read it, it is a pastiche of everything that makes superhero comics.
Is it an independent title?
No, it was a Marvel title.
Really?
Yeah. Huh.
Okay.
Yeah, it's available now in two hardbacks.
Agents of Hate.
But it's basically a group of second-tier superheroes wind up finding out that they're working for the bad guys and steal a ship and try to destroy all the bad guys' plans. But the bad guys are basically... Nick Fury with S.H.I.E.L.D.
Oh,
but it's called Hate, H-A-T-E, so Agents of Hate.
Gotcha.
Very nice.
Cool.
I'll check that out. And Aaron?
Well, there's two, and I think one of them is about to be done, but Doctor Strange has always been one I would love to see. I saw that horrible made-for-TV movie and have watched it. Actually, I'm probably one of the few people that have watched it multiple times. Just because I love Doctor Strange. I mean, what a great character. There's an animated one that's much closer to his origin story and actually a lot more true to the comics that I've enjoyed quite a bit. I've tried to get Elena to sit down and watch it. She's just not that terribly interested in Doctor Strange. But anyway. You mean who's going to play him or who plays him in the
animated? Who plays him in the horrible movie?
I don't even remember.
Some guy with a porn stash. It doesn't matter.
Yeah, it pretty much. I really don't even remember.
Because it's like Hasselhoff played Nick Fury.
And somebody that recognizable. No. Yeah, it's not even somebody that recognizable.
They are going to give Cumberbatch the little stash, I'm sure.
He will. I think he has the goatee. I think he actually has the full goatee.
Okay,
he does not. God, I'd be okay to never see a porn stash on Doctor Strange ever.
Technically, he'll have is a Van Dyke in that case if he's kept the same.
Yes, well, that's what I mean. A Van Dyke is kind of what I call a goatee is really the Van Dyke. But the other one I'd love to see is The Submariner. I love to see, and it's a shame, it is a shame, Jason Momoa has been cast as Aquaman, because he is Namor. He looks like The Submariner, and you can see Momoa with his hair all greased back, and that physique and that scowl in those tiny little green, you know, Speedo with the wings on his feet. He would look fantastic. He is Namor, and they'll never do it. I think because if the Aquaman movie, if they go through with the Aquaman movie, and apparently they're going to, I think that will put the kibosh on any kind of Submariner appearance. But I've always liked the Submariner, and he's one of the classic Golden Age heroes.
Right, one of the original Defenders
for the Invaders.
Invaders. That's
yes.
Right. That's right.
No, I would love to see, especially Momoa as, but Submariner, Doctor Strange.
He always looked like a pissed off FTD florist man. He was really with the wings on his feet.
The Submariner.
Angry. Well, gentlemen, it's that time, I'm afraid. So this episode of Gentlemen Nerds has been brought to you by Clancy Brown, Gorilla Grodd, and the Texas Polar Bear. So until next time we meet here at the Lobot Lounge, we're all going to take a minute and tell our Sarah goodnights, Master Finn.
Good night, everyone, and have a pleasant tomorrow.
That's good. Mickey Finn.
Good night. You said Mr. Finn. We both answered.
I know.
Sorry.
Aaron?
Excelsior!
Oh, nicely done. And from all of us here, don't thank me. We're all on the same team. Good night.
Well played.
Gentlemen Nerds is a production of Cloak & Dagger Studios, LLC. Music by Ben Gibbs. The sound editor is Michael Ashley Finn. Web design and cloakanddaggerstudios.com by Rustix Interactive. Promotional consideration by The Daily Planet.